Hello, my name is Craig Barker. I'm the Head of Public Engagement at the Chow Chakwing Museum at the University of Sydney. Welcome to the podcast, Object Matters. Object Matters explores the relationship between our guest and a museum collection item. For this particular episode, I am especially thrilled to be joined by Dr. Ksenia Radchenko, an art historian and an educator. Ksenia, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us on Object Matters.
Good morning, Craig. Thank you for having me.
Look, can I begin by asking a bit about your background and your research interests? Because it's interesting that what we're talking about today is actually a little bit different, or actually quite radically different from your own training and your own background. What drove you to do your doctorate on art of the Slavic regions in the 20th century?
Absolutely, Craig. I received my PhD at the University of Southern California in 2019, and I'm coming from Slavic background, so this was the area that I've always been interested in, and I was fascinated by Slavic art, Russian art, Ukrainian art. My dissertation was devoted to the depiction of death in Russian modernism, and I guess that it has some connection with archaeology and excavations. And ancient cultures too, so it's not completely different. I was exploring how traditionally in Slavic Orthodox culture, death was depicted quite conservatively. So it actually affected the depiction of dead bodies in art as well. However, in the late 19th century, there was a naturalistic shift in the depiction of sick, ailing, and dead bodies. So I explore several Russian artists and writers, find that this shift coincided with the development of medical science, X-ray, many other scientific advancements. Also amidst the terrible events of the early 20th century, such as wars, revolutions, assassinations, this trend for me serves as the implementation of the medieval iconography of the memento mori, or remember that you will die, because surprisingly there were many images of skeletons referring to the dance of death that are quite popular in medieval European culture. Interestingly for me, the sacrality of death was restored after this event of Lenin's embalmment with this appearance of kind of new sacred body for the emerging Soviet reality. So I'm trying to convert it into a book now. I'm also very interested in the influence of Slavic modernism on European and Western abstractions of the 60s, which actually plays very well with the recent exhibition at Chow Chakwing Museum, the Light and Darkness. Yes, and we saw several excellent examples of how Western artists of the 60s and 70s worried that Kazimir Malevich's famous black square was lost. They paid his, they paid the tribute to his artwork by kind of reproducing some replicas as well as tributes to his works.
Interesting. Just before we move on from the topic, were you finding that a lot of the movements taking place in the early 20th century were developing internally within Eastern Europe and within Russia or the Soviet Union by that stage, or is there influence coming from outside as well? Are there, you know, influences from Western art traditions?
Actually, unlike now, Russia was quite influenced by the European trends in the beginning of the century. Artists and writers, they traveled abroad and they brought some influences back home. And I'm also very interested in the emergence of these experimental art schools that emerged both in Germany and in Soviet Union, such as Bauhaus and the Museum of Painterly Culture in Soviet Union. So there was definitely this, you know, famous Kandinsky taught in Munich and taught in Russia, the emerging Soviet Union schools. So there was definitely an influence, a co-influence between Russia and Europe.
Now, of course, I suspect that anyone who's listened to the podcast before would probably expect now for us to talk about a work of art from the Soviet Union within the collection, which is not, regrettably, not one of the areas of collection strength of the Chow Chakwing Museum. Could you talk a bit about how you're engaging with the Chow Chakwing Museum currently? Because it's in a number of different ways, isn't it?
Yes. I'm very happy to be an education officer here at Chow Chakwing Museum. I started working here when the Light and Darkness exhibition was on, so I was helping with the preparation of materials for the workshops. And now I'm actually doing my internship here. And I'm, as an intern, I'm here at quite a different role. I'm working in the collection management, which is the area that interests me a lot, because I'm finishing my master's of art curating. And yes, I can quote Socrates, who said that he only knew that he knew nothing. And it really applies to my life story, I would say. So yeah, I'm almost at the end of my studies here at the University of Sydney. And this is my final internship, where I work with Candice Richards. I'm working on the registration of the extensive collection of coin electrotypes that the museum, the Nicholson Van Museum, bought for the Nicholson collection in 1945. The collection of almost 800 electrotypes of Roman and Greek coins has never been registered into the collection management system. So my goal is to make it accessible for the researchers and for the teaching team, because otherwise you don't even know what you have in the collection.
We'll talk more about the project as we go along. I just wanted to talk to you a bit more about the Masters of Art Curating, because I suspect some of our listeners are not aware the University of Sydney offers that as a subject. And similarly, there's also a Masters of Museum Studies as well. Mm-hmm. And having finished your PhD too, I mean, to go back to being a student, I'm crazy. But that aside, I mean, you know, how are you finding that actual process? It's a two-year course, isn't it?
Yes, it is. With COVID interruptions, it took me almost 3 years. It's a great program. I am so thrilled to be a part of it. Because while anybody doing a PhD always finds that it's very theoretical, the master's program that the University of Sydney offers, both in art curating and museum and heritage studies, is very practical. So you get an insight from many museum specialists. You have many guests at the lecture, so you can get the valuable hands-on experience that is really important, especially when you move from another country. You don't know the specifics of, especially working in museums. It's very important to know the specifics of the country that you're working in.
So the internship itself, how long does it go for? And what do you find to be the value of the internship? Or what are you getting out of it yourself?
It's 21 days, and I really find it fascinating because you get quite a different aspect of working in a museum. As an educational officer, I've usually worked with the audience, like working on some public programming. Here I get at the backstage of the museum. Yes. And it's so thrilling to be in the storage, actually. When I talk to my fellow education specialists here in the museum, they say that they've never been there in the storage. So I'm quite thrilled that I had a chance of being there.
Now, you started to talk about how the project was based around the electrotypes in the Nicholson collection, and you were working with curator Candice Richards in terms of proper cataloguing and recording of all of that collection. What are the aims? I mean, can you achieve all of this in the 21 days of the internship?
I'm actually not the first intern working on this project, but I'm lucky to be the last, hopefully. I've already put in about 250 coins.
Wow.
And being the last, I have this pleasure of having those unidentified coins in my hand. So I had about 60 coins that the previous interns didn't identify, because they didn't have the numbers corresponding to the catalog that we're using. So we have the catalog written by a famous numismat, Barclay Head, from the British Museum. It was written and published in 1890.
Yep.
And unfortunately, it doesn't have many pictures.
Right. So it's just got a description of
the electrotypes. But no pictures. So some coins have the little plaques with numbers in the bags that they are in. But those 50 or 60 coins did not have, or they had and they didn't correspond to the description. So I had to figure out what those coins were. And as you know, I'm not a specialist in mathematics. But I guess that now I am.
A bit of detective work.
Yeah. It was tricky in the beginning, but once you start and you can differentiate the coins by different eras and different geographical regions, you get better and you can guess correctly. And also you have to search by the image. in this catalog. So sometimes, for example, I had a trouble figuring out the coin with the octopus as I saw it. It's, yes, it's definitely an octopus, a beautifully engraved octopus. I was searching by octopus squid and I couldn't find it. So it turned out that it was a cuttlefish.
Ah, right. Yes.
And after that, you know, it's funny how a bit of luck helps you in
So we've used the word electrotypes a couple of times already, but for our listeners who don't know what an electrotype is and that relationship between an electrotype and a genuine coin, could you take us through what are electrotypes and why do they exist?
So an electrotype or electrotyping is a method for creating a copy of an object, in our case a coin, by electrodepositing a thin layer of metal, either golden color or silver color, onto a mold of the original object. So to make an electrotype of a coin, the coin would first have to be coated in a thin layer of wax or another insulating material. Then a mold of the coin would be made by pressing the coin into a soft material such as clay or plaster. And the mold would then be filled with a liquid solution of metal ions.
Yep.
And an electric current would be applied to the mold, causing the metal ions to deposit on the surface of the mold and form a thin layer of metal.
Yep.
So this thin metal layer would then be removed from the mold to create an exact copy of the original coin. And obviously with the coins, we have the obverse and the reverse. So we have two metal layers, two metal molds glued together with a special glue. And we have the exact copy of the coin, which is much better than a plaster copy because it has all this detailing and you can study it in...
Not to mention it looks more...
It looks more authentic, absolutely, absolutely. And it has this color of the original coin. So if you don't have a plaque with a number, you can start by gold or silver coin, struck from gold or from silver coin. So electrotyping is used often by the museums to create the copies of the coins for teaching purposes and for the research purposes so that we don't damage the original coin. And they are obviously very valuable themselves because they're made out of silver or gold. So it's a very delicate method of handling almost authentic objects.
So it's that sense of creating replicas for educational purposes and research purposes.
Absolutely.
It's, I guess, in a sense, the 21st century equivalent is 3D scanning and 3D printing.
Yes,
although,
yes.
Of course, the caveat coins are very, very difficult to do that with. This is really sort of the late 19th and 20th century equivalent, isn't it, this idea of creating those replicas?
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that we're talking about it today because it was actually invented in St. Petersburg.
Really?
Absolutely, by an Austrian scientist.
Yes.
In 1838.
Right, okay.
So it has a long history of...
Because I know it's been used for jewelry and other items as well, too.
Yeah, some vases, and metal, other metal objects. So it's a very interesting way of creating copies. And for teaching purposes, it's important for us that we can give it to the students to handle it because it's very important that we have this hands-on experience.
So the set of the electrotype coins that you are studying as part of the internship that came to Australia after World War II. We'll talk more about that in a moment. So they were created as part of a set to be sold, or were they, you know, selected by the Nicholson curators as, I want one of those and one of those? How did it sort of operate commercially?
So it was a set of electrotype of the coins created by the British Museum.
Yes.
As a copy of their collection of the coins.
Oh, I see.
That was meant to be used for teaching and was sold to the Nicholson collection for £125.
Okay.
And initially, of course, I guess it was planned to be used in teaching.
Yes. Now, which one of the electrotype copies of the coins have you chosen to discuss today?
Oh, it's a very exciting one. So the electrotype of the coin that I want to talk more about today is the Lydian coin from 400s BC.
Yes.
So according to Barclay Head catalog, the reverse represents the head of the Persian satrap or the king. And if it is indeed a portrait, it would be the earliest portrait of a ruler which occurs on the coin.
Yes. And Lydia, of course, is that region of southwestern Turkey, coastal region of southwestern Turkey. My understanding, that's where coins developed initially in the first
place. So they were pioneers of coins, obviously. And according to Herodotus, the Lydians were the first people to cast silver and gold coins.
Right.
In this collection of the electrotypes of the coins, we have the very first Lydian coins,
yep.
Which are quite simple. They were made out of gold. They have a picture of a lion and a bull and quite roughly done in Q square at the back,
yep.
at the reverse side of the coin. So it's interesting that this region was the first to make coins and
yep.
use coins and then to create the first portrait of a real person to be put on the coin.
I mean,
because before it was mostly gods, goddesses, you know, some pawns, some symbols.
Yes, yes.
But never real people.
Never real people. I mean, it's interesting because, of course, today it's inconceivable to think of coinage without a portrait on it.
Absolutely.
I mean, obviously we in Australia have, well, still the Queen, but eventually we'll have a portrait of King Charles III, the United States presidents and so on and so on and so on. And, of course, we know, you know, Roman coins with emperors. And it's really interesting, such an important development as well. Any idea why the Lydians were beginning to actually put rulers on it? Was it some degree of state control?
It was the period when the Persians kind of won over the original Lydians. So I guess it was indeed the form of state control and implementation of the new system.
And it spreads.
Yes, it does.
Very rapidly. So why did you choose this one? I mean, it's interesting, obviously, in terms of having the portrait, but why were you drawn to this particular, the 800?
As an art historian, obviously, I was fascinated by the fact that it only happened in 400 BC when the portraits appeared on the coins. And for me, actually, it was such a revelation because I've never thought about coins as kind of art historian objects, right?
Yeah.
I thought about coins in the terms of material culture,
yes.
Social culture, but never in this art historian way.
Mm, mm.
Because this whole collection of electrotypes, the coins that we have here now, shows the whole range of the development of the image from the simple symbols into elaborated portraits from Roman Empire.
So from that perspective, what does the portrait actually look like on the coin? I mean, the coin itself is not particularly large.
It's very small, yes. And it's a head of a Persian, looks like a Persian warrior. If I didn't know that it was a king, I would say that it's a Persian warrior wearing the specific hat.
Yes.
Persian hat. And it's very, you know, attractive, and it has so many details. And I'm fascinated at the amount of details and how these early coins from, say, 500 BC, 400 BC, can show the plasticity of the figure, for example, when they depict some god, right, Apollo or Athena. And this little animalistic images that you have there. For example, there are some coins depicting Hercules with the crab helping him, and the crab is tiny.
Yeah.
And there's little birds sitting on cows and depicting the goddess Persephone. And the owls that symbolize Athena, they're wonderful and really miniature works of art.
Mm. So the original of this coin is in the collection at the British Museum in London, and I'm assuming it's in the catalogue as well. It's interesting, you know, we talked about how this study is so different from your previous life, but I believe that there is actually a connection between Russian 20th century thought and coins and copies of coins too, isn't there?
Exactly, exactly. I was so surprised to find out that one of the prominent emigre philosophers, Vasily Rozanov, who was sent out on this so-called philosopher's ship out of Russia in 1921 when the revolution happened, he was very fond of ancient coins,
yes.
And he had a collection of 6,000 coins.
Wow.
Himself, and he was devastated when he discovered the state of numismatics in Russian museums. So he created his own catalog, and he wrote a manuscript on ancient coins. And he said that for him, ancient coins were a way to feel the lives of the past. And he said that once, I quote, he held an ancient coin in his arms, everything would blur around him, and he would see and hear the voices from the past, from 2,000 years ago.
Fascinating approach, isn't it? That idea of that direct connection with antiquity. And of course, coins are such an interesting object anyway, because they haven't changed radically. So what we have in our pocket today, or the few coins we still have, are really a reminder of that long tradition going back to Lydia.
Absolutely, absolutely.
You're listening to Object Matters, the podcast of the Chow Chak Wing Museum. My guest for this episode is Dr. Ksenia Radchenko. So we know that this was a set purchased from the British Museum by the old Nicholson Museum at the University of Sydney in 1945. And we know that the fundamental rationale for their existence was educational. Were they used in Sydney when they came across?
Absolutely. They've been used in some exhibitions as well as in teaching workshops. We know it because some of the plagues with numbers that I was matching with the original catalogue were mismatched.
Ah, so someone's taken them out, not put them back properly.
And also, at some point in time, I guess Nicholson Museum or the University of Sydney made their own copies of these electrotypes.
Yes.
They are of worse quality,
yes.
A bit dodgy, and they tend to fall apart when you handle it. So that's how we definitely know that they've been used in the previous exhibitions.
Right. But they were never formally accessioned into the collection process.
No, that's why it's a bit hard to make use of them now, because you can't search by selection criteria, like, for example, Persian images on coins.
So the end result of the overall project is to have them all formally accessioned into the collection?
Absolutely.
Fully described and then available for researchers?
For the researchers and for students.
Fantastic. So it's nice to know that those sort of things hidden away in collections are still being worked upon.
Coming to the surface.
What do these objects to you tell us about the connections between the originals and the desire to have these copies?
Well, for me, it's a very challenging project because you have to, match it with the original catalogue. The electrotypes that we have here in the collection are of really good quality. So you definitely feel the connection between the originals and this copies, and it's fascinating to have the whole range of those coins dating from 700 BC to the first century of AD, which is really valuable.
So the collection itself from the British Museum is quite widespread. So that's been a challenge then for you too, I guess, looking at Roman imperial coinage one day and
jumping
then,
from especially Greek city states those mismatched labeled coins. It was quite a challenge because it might be a coin from Lydia from 700, some of the first coins. Actually, it's interesting that those were the ones without number plates,
right,
because they've probably been used in the exhibitions.
Yeah, and that might also represent where the Nicholson collection had genuine coins of a particular type, and then things that obviously, such as the Lydian coins, we haven't had.
And I read that in the late 19th century, some electrotypes were of such a great quality that they've been used as forgeries, right? Obviously, sold as forgeries.
Yes.
I mean, sold as authentic coins and bought as authentic coins, but they were actually mere copies.
Oh, fascinating. Fascinating. As we record this, we're coming towards the end of your internship. Have you found the way that you are connecting with the electrotypes have changed as the research has progressed?
Yes. I now can call myself a specialist in ancient coins, because it was, for me, it was this revelation moment. I saw these tiny scarab beetles on top of the cows, and I immediately recognized that it didn't have the number, obviously. So I figured out that this was a coin from Cyprus, from about 400 BC. And then I thought, oh my goodness, I'm now getting there.
So you're going from 20th century Russian art to 20th century copies of coins from antiquity.
Yes.
What's next?
I'm looking forward to all the challenges.
Now, what I ask everyone who appears on the podcast is if you can choose a single word to describe the electrotype, either the individual one you've selected or the collection more broadly, what word would that be?
I think I'll repeat myself and I'll say that it would be a challenging, but at the same time, it's exciting and fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Rewarding from our perspective to have these objects now
And I'm very happy that at the end, this would be a fully registered collection ready for the use in education.
Fantastic. So now that it will soon be available, what would you like visitors to the museum or students and researchers using our online catalogue, when they get to see the electrotype collection finally, what would you like them to think about?
I would like the visitors and the researchers and the students to see this abundance range of imagery and this archhistorian value that I saw in the coins that I've never previously thought of.
So besides the portrait, and you talked about the cuttlefish before, are there any particular ones that stand out in your mind?
These little depictions of crabs at the feet of Hercules helping him. Yeah. Also, it was very interesting to see how the depiction of Hercules changed in time.
Yeah.
And in some later coins, we see some, you know, weirdly unpleasant images of Hercules. And it's hard to say why, because in about like 20, 30 years later, the coins, which would have pretty much the same head of Hercules with the lion sculpt on it, they would just turn handsome. And those would be, a bit blurry. And maybe there was some issues with metal or artists engraving.
I mean, obviously, with images. Minting of coins, the stage and the process of how the coin's minted, you get, you know, sharper lines and clarity earlier on and duller as it goes along. Do you see those changes replicated within the electrotypes because they are such perfect copies?
Yes, this first Lydian coins, I guess it was hard to identify them because the first images are really blurry and sometimes they would just have incused square or incused triangle at the back or incused rectangle as only ways to identify those and compare it to the catalog record. They were quite, you know, simple.
Yeah.
And as you go further in time, they get more elaborated. And it's interesting to follow those myths and gods who were popular in certain cities, how they keep replicating them in the passage of time and how the image changes, how it becomes more developed.
Thank you for taking us on this journey. It's really fascinating to see, you know, how you can study ancient coinage, but by using these copies, and which were, again, the whole purpose of them as teaching collections, weren't they? But it's been a pleasure having you on. Object Matters is recorded on the grounds of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. The Chow Chak Wing Museum pays our respects to the traditional custodians of the lands in which we work.
Subscribe to Object Matters on your favourite podcast app and connect with the Chow Chak Wing Museum on Instagram, Twitter and Facebook. You can also subscribe to our monthly e-newsletter, News Extra, via our website, sydney.edu.au/museum.